Well, I had something very fascinating happen to me. It wasn't this last week, but it was the week before. I don't know why this stuff happens to me, but for some reason it does. I was actually at home working, and the doorbell rang. So I go to the front door, and I open it up, and here's this young man in his 20s, probably his late 20s, and he's standing there, and in one hand is a bottle of what looks like some sort of cleaner, and the other hand is a wash rag. And he says, "Hello there." He says, "I'm here because I noticed that by your front door, you've got this rust stain, and I want to clean it up for you." And I said to him, "Rust stain?" I didn't even realize I had a rust stain. And I look over, and sure enough, we had had this plant by the front door, and it somehow it must have leaked or something, and there was a rust stain because the plant's no longer there, because plants never last very long at our house. So he looks at this rust stain. He says, "I want to clean that for you." And I said, "That's great. That is wonderful." I said, "You want to clean that rust stain?" He says, "Yes, I want to clean that rust stain." And I said, "You go at it and clean the rust stain." And I got back in the house, and I locked the door, and I went back to work. And he's ringing the doorbell, but see, what he doesn't understand is that I'm saving him a lot of time, because I know that after he cleans the rust stain, he's going to show me how wonderful it looks now that the rust stain is gone. And what did that? It was this magical potion that he had in his bottle. And for just $25, I can have some of this magical potion and put on the rust stain. But see, what he doesn't know is that I live with Jennifer. And if I spent $25 for a bottle of $5 cleaner, she would have my throat. And so I saved him all of that and just let him clean it without, you know, me being there. But the fact is, did he clean the rust stain? No, he didn't clean the rust stain. As soon as I went back in-house and locked the door, he realized that he wasn't going to get a sale, and so he left. See, that's how salesmen work, right? They come in, and they do something for you, and then they kind of expect you to do something back for him. It's kind of, and if you don't do something back, then you feel really, really, really bad, right? And so you feel almost compelled, this empathy, to do what because he's cleaned your stain, that you're going to buy his product from him. And I don't want to get into that, because I know how the world works. The world works with man's math. But see, we're called as Christians to work with God's math, and God's math is entirely different than man's math. And an example of that is from our gospel lesson today in The Workers of the Vineyard. We're continuing to go through this book, What's So Amazing About Grace by Philip Yancey, and one of the examples about God's mathematics is the worker in the vineyard. Now, the guy goes, and he goes, and he gets people from the marketplace, and they start early in the morning, just as the sun is about to rise, and they go and they work in the vineyard, and then throughout the day, he goes back to the same marketplace, and he gets more and more and more workers until finally it's after the heat of the day, and it's pretty much almost the time for the day to close, and he goes and gets one last handful of workers. They come in, everybody works in the vineyard, but everybody works different times, and when it comes time to paying him, he starts with the people who only worked about an hour, and how much does he give them? A denarius. Now, a denarius is the typical day labor rate for labor in that time. If you were going to work a day in somebody's field, then you were expected to get a denarius. That was the going rate. And yet, he goes and he gives a full denarius to people who had only worked an hour. And so the other people at the end of the line who've worked all day, it's like, "Man, I mean, I have probably 10 denarius. This is awesome." They just get a denarius. And they're furious with the landowner. "How could you do that? You gave them one denarius and you gave us denarius, but we all work different times." But see, they were working on God's math. God was telling the parable. Jesus was telling the parable about God's math. And God's math is different than man's math. Totally different from man's math. Jesus Christ was telling the story about the denarius to let people know that man's math just doesn't work at all. And that's the important part of the story. God always works with his math. God's math always doesn't add up. For example, the story of the lost sheep. You think about the story of the lost sheep. The guy goes and he leaves the 99 sheep in the field and he goes out and he gets the lost sheep. And he comes back because the lost sheep is so important. But what you don't know is that the 99 that were left, they were left by themselves in the field where they could go and wander off, or where a lion could come and eat them. I mean, really, in our world, would we leave the 99 sheep and go and find the one sheep? I mean, even Spock knows about this, right? Last Friday night, we watched Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. And if you'll remember in Star Trek II, Spock dies, gives up his life. Why? Because the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one. And that's the math that we work on, the human math. But God's math is totally different. God would leave the 99 and go after the one. Or how about this one, the widow's mite? You remember that story? The lady goes and she puts her two mites in the offering basket at the temple. And Jesus points to her and says, that woman is giving absolutely everything she has. And God is blessing her more than the people who gave, you know, a lot of money, but it wasn't everything they had. See, that doesn't make any sense to us. I mean, if we had two people and one of them gave just a couple coins and another gave, you know, like $1 million, I guarantee you that we would see a difference in that. But we're humans. We work by human math. We don't work by God's math. Or how about this one? When Mary, remember there was this time when Jesus came to the home of Mary and she took this beautiful jar of alabaster perfume and just poured it over Jesus' feet. And the disciple Judas was absolutely furious about this because apparently that jar was worth a lot of money. And he's thinking, you know, in man's math, we could take a lot with that money and we could give it and feed the poor. And yet Jesus says, anytime that you shower me with anything is money well spent. That is God's math. But it's not man's math. Man's math simply doesn't work. Go back to the story of the worker in the vineyard. You see, what they don't tell you is what happened the next day. Because we're all trying to game the system, right? He goes back the next day and he says, okay, I need workers for my vineyard. What happens? They look at him and say, yeah, why don't you come back about 4 o'clock and then we'll talk. Because they'd seen what a generous guy he was. They weren't going to go spend all day. They're always trying to game the system. That's the way humans work. We always want to make sure we get exactly what's coming to us, or if we can game the system, we want more. But that's totally different than God's math. And the fact is, it doesn't work. God's math does not work in this world. It'll get you into trouble. Just try it sometime. I challenge all of you to go to work tomorrow and walk into your boss's office and say, listen, you know, I'm a generous guy. I'm just going to work for free the whole week this week. I'm still going to put in the same amount of time. I'm going to do the same things, but you don't have to pay me a thing, right? Your boss, well, he'd commit you. I mean, it just wouldn't work. Or how about if Fry's offered a sale and they said, okay, today on today it's Fry's Day, you can come in and anything in our store is free, all right? You can just come in and get whatever you want, however much you want until the shelves are bare. I mean, you and I know that, I mean, I'd go get the Christ Lutheran Vale trailer, hook it onto my collar, go into this Fry's and try to get as much stuff as I possibly could. Because that's what, that's the human nature thing. We don't understand God's math and God's math doesn't work, but yet we're called to follow God's math of grace. And God's math of grace is totally different than man's grace, man's understanding of grace. And I sometimes wonder if we as the church understand about God's grace and how much he's loved us and how much he's called us to live under his math. We're always thinking we're going to get exactly what we're deserved and no more and no less. That's exactly what we're going to get. There's a story that he tells Philip Yancey in his book about Irma Bombeck. You all remember Irma Bombeck? She wrote this. In church the other day, I was intent on a small child who was turning around smiling at everyone. He wasn't gurgling, spitting, humming, kicking, tearing the hymnals, or rummaging through his mother's handbag. He was just smiling. Finally, his mother jerked him out, and with a stage whisper that could be heard in a little theater off Broadway, she said, "Stop that grinning. You're in church." And with that, she gave him a belt, and as the tears rolled down his cheeks, she added, "That's better," and returned to her prayers. Suddenly, I was angry. It occurred to me that the entire world is in tears. And if you're not, then you'd better get with it. I wanted to grab this child with the tear-stained face close to me and tell him about my God, the happy God, the smiling God, the God who had to have a sense of humor to have created the likes of us. By tradition, one wears faith with the solemnity of a mourner, the gravity of a mask of tragedy, and the dedication of a rotary badge. What a fool, I thought. Here was a woman sitting next to the only light left in our civilization, the only hope, our only miracle, our only promise of infinity. If he couldn't smile in church, where was there left to go? We're called to follow God's math of grace, and yet sometimes we just don't do a very good job of it. Mark Twain once quipped that he said he put a dog and a cat in a cage as an experiment. And after a while, the dog and the cat got along. So he decided to extend the experiment, and he put in a bird, a pig, and a goat. And believe it or not, with a few adjustments, they still got along. Then he said that he put in a Baptist, a Lutheran, and a Catholic. He said there wasn't a soul left. We don't operate with God's grace sometimes. Or W.C. Fields. I guess the agnostic W.C. Fields was getting ready for performance, and somebody went into the room where he was getting ready, and he was caught reading a Bible. And he quickly put the Bible away, and he said, well, I was just looking for loopholes. But the fact is, he was probably looking for grace, because this world is starved for grace. And the only place where you can get grace, God's amazing grace, is here, at a place where we dish out God's amazing grace. Jesus doesn't follow the world's math. Jesus doesn't follow the math that we follow. He follows his own math, a math where the worker in the vineyard who works just 1 hour gets everything that he has to give him, or the blessings of God come just flowing, overflowing to him. That's God's grace, and it's a good thing that that's God's grace. In Philip's book, he tells a story of a young girl. A young girl grows up on a cherry orchard just above Traverse City, Michigan. Her parents, a bit old-fashioned, tend to overreact to her nose ring, the music she listens to, and the length of her skirts. They ground her a few times, and she seethes inside, "I hate you." She screams at her father when he knocks on the door of her room after an argument, and that night she acts out on a plan that she has mentally rehearsed dozens of times before. She runs away. She has visited Detroit only once before, on a bus trip with her church youth group to watch the Tigers play, because the newspapers in Traverse City report in lurid detail the gangs and the drugs and the violence in downtown Detroit. She concludes that that is probably the last place that her parents will look for her. California, maybe. Florida, probably, but not Detroit. Her second day there, she meets a man who drives the biggest car she's ever seen. He offers her a ride and buys her lunch, arranges for a place for her to stay. He gives her pills that make her feel better than she's ever felt before. And she was right all along, she decides. Her parents were keeping her from all of the fun. The good life continues for a month, 2 months, a year. The man with the big car, she calls him boss, teaches her few things. She's underage. Men pay a premium for her. She lives in a penthouse. She orders room service whenever she wants. Occasionally, she thinks about the folks back home, but their lives now seem to be so boring and so provincial that she can hardly believe she grew up there. She has a brief scare when she sees her picture printed on the back of a milk carton with the headline, "Have you seen this child?" But by now, she has blonde hair, and with all the makeup and body-piercing jewelry she wears, nobody would mistake her for a child. Besides, most of her friends are runaways, and nobody squeals in Detroit. After a year, the first sallow signs of illness appear, and it amazes her how fast the boss turns mean. "Well, these days we can't mess around," he growls, and before she knows it, she's out on the street without a penny. When winter blows in, she finds herself sleeping on metal grates outside the big department stores. Sleeping is the wrong word. A teenage girl at night in downtown Detroit can never relax her guard. Dark bands circle her eyes. Her cough worsens. One night, as she lies awake, listening for footsteps, all of a sudden, everything about her life looks different. She no longer feels like a woman of the world. She feels like a little girl, lost in a cold and frightening city. She begins to whimper. Her pockets are empty, and she's hungry. She needs a fix. She pulls her legs tight underneath her and shivers under the newspapers she's piled atop her coat. Something jolts a synapse of memory, and a single image fills her mind. Of May in Traverse City, when a million cherry trees bloom at once, with her golden retriever dashing through the rows and rows of blossomy trees in chase of a tennis ball. Why did I leave? She says to herself, and a pain stabs at her heart. My dog back home eats better than I do now. She's sobbing, and she knows in a flash that more than anything else in the world, she wants to go home. Three straight phone calls, three straight connections with the answering machine. She hangs up without leaving a message the first two times, but the third time she says, Dad, Mom, it's me. I was wondering about maybe coming home. I'm catching a bus up your way, and it'll get there about midnight tomorrow. If you're not there, well, I guess I'll just stay on the bus until it hits Canada. It takes about 7 hours for the bus to make all the stops between Detroit and Traverse City. And during that time, she realizes the flaws in her plan. What if her parents are out of town and missed the message? Shouldn't she have waited another day or so until she could talk to them? And even if they are home, they probably wrote her off as dead long ago. She should have given them some time to overcome the shock. Her thoughts bounce back and forth between these worries and the speech she is preparing for her father. Dad, I'm sorry. I know I was wrong. It's not your fault. It's all mine. Dad, can you forgive me? She says the words over and over, her throat tightening, even as she rehearses them. She hasn't apologized to anyone in years. The bus has been driving with lights on since Bay City. Tiny snowflakes hit the pavement, rubbed worn by thousands of tires, and the asphalt streams. She's forgotten how dark it gets out night. A deer darts across the road and the bus swerves. Every so often, a billboard, a sign posting the mileage to Traverse City. When the bus finally rolls into the station, its air brakes hissing in protest, the driver announces in a crackly voice over the microphone, 15 minutes, folks, 15 minutes, that's all we've got. 15 minutes to decide her life. She checks herself in a compact mirror, smooths her hair, and licks the lipstick off her teeth. She looks at the tobacco stains on her fingertips and wonders if her parents will notice, if they're there. She walks into the terminal not knowing what to expect. Not one of the thousand scenes that have played out in her mind prepare her for what she sees. Because there in the concrete wall and plastic chairs bus terminal in Traverse City, Michigan, stands a group of 40 brothers and sisters and great aunts and uncles and cousins and a grandmother and a great grandmother to boot. And they're all wearing goofy party hats and blowing noisemakers, and taped across the entire wall of the terminal is a computer-generated banner that reads, Welcome Home. Out of the crowd of well-wishers breaks her dad. She stares out through the tears quivering in her eyes like hot mercury and begins the memorized speech. Dad, I know, I'm sorry. He interrupts her. Hush, child. We've got no time for that. No time for apologies. You'll be late for the party. A banquet's waiting for you at home. God's math doesn't work like man's math. In man's math, you get what you pay for. You make your bed and you sleep in it. But see, God's math is a math that always is a God who is generous and loving and cares for each and every single one of you. We're like the girl in the story. We're the ones that have run away from God. And yet every time we come back home, he opens his arms and loves us as a father only could. That is what is so amazing about grace. In Jesus' name.